based on a true story. There is no phrase that can draw us into movie theaters and terrify us more while we're munching our popcorn than based on a true story. The idea that someone really could have experienced anything like what we're seeing on the screen has thrilled us since the days of early Hollywood. While some of the most effective and frightening horror films manage to scare us because they act as metaphors for deep-seated human fears, whether it's the anxiety of parenthood, financial insecurities, or the grief of losing a loved one, but sometimes a movie is so horrifying because, well, it really happened to someone. And such is the case with every episode of our new upcoming season, season number 9, which we'll be calling Based on a True Story. In this season, we'll be revealing 24 films, all of which have some kernel of truth behind them, or in some instances, a lot of kernels of truth. With every episode, we'll bring you real-life stories of horror, of ghosts, demons, hauntings, crime, murder, and the supernatural, and introduce you to the films that were made based on those stories. With all of these films, the actual events may be embellished, but they skew close enough to the real incidents that telling yourself it's only a movie won't be enough to stop your spine from tingling or your bones from chilling, or for some of you, from turning on every light in the house and taking deep breaths into a paper bag. Because that's the thing. These stories aren't only a movie. And the real-life events are a lot scarier than anything a director and a cast and a crew could put onto a movie screen. So welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to our introductory episode for season 9, based on a true story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. This season, we'll be buying the popcorn and taking to the movies with a collection of horrific tales that have been turned into some of the most terrifying films ever made. Well, let's get this one out of the way right now. It's the white whale of horror films based on a true story. The Exorcist. If you got excited about this season of the podcast thinking I'd be spending a lot of time on this one, I won't be. Not only did we devote 6 episodes to this story back in the St. Louis season of the podcast, but I've written an entire book about the story called The Devil Came to St. Louis, which has been optioned to be turned into a film itself. Now, try not to think about a movie based on a book about a case that was turned into a book and a movie. That will really make your head hurt. In a nutshell, there was an exorcism that took place in St. Louis in 1949 that involved a young man referred to as Roland Doe, although his real name was Ronald Hunkler. It's the best documented possession in American history, thanks to a diary kept by the priests involved in interviews with witnesses, and over time it became so notorious that it inspired the book and the film The Exorcist. Ronald was just 13 when the alleged possession began, and events started with strange noises, scratching sounds, and what seemed to be a haunting in his family's home in Maryland, followed by more violent activity in a relative's home in St. Louis. Ronald's exorcism continued for weeks, and it eventually freed him of what everyone involved believed was a demon. When it was over, he had no memory of the incident. During the exorcism, though, the violent activity was witnessed by dozens of people. The priests, family members, Alexian monks, and hospital staff, and they attested to odd noises, furniture moving by itself, objects levitating, and even Ronnie's incredible strength. And when it was all over, despite 48 people who signed witness statements attesting to the reality of the events, the church decided not to publicize it, and the true events and the names of those involved became a secret. Well, in the summer after the events in St. Louis, a Lutheran minister who'd been briefly involved in the case presented a paper that he'd written about Ronald to a parapsychology group in Washington, D.C. He believed that Ronald had been the victim of poltergeist activity, not a demon. But he did add, at the end of his presentation, that the boy had gone to St. Louis where, quote, an exorcism had been performed. Well, a newspaper reporter at the meeting immediately perked up when he heard exorcism, and for the next several days, newspapers all over D.C. ran the story, repeating what little they knew because no one could talk about what had happened. The newspaper reports were read with interest by a young seminary student who was attending Georgetown University at the time, studying to become a priest. He filed the stories away, not realizing he'd ever need them or use them for anything. Later, he dropped out of the seminary and became a television comedy writer who decided to try his hand at writing a novel. Remembering the story he'd heard in 1949, the former seminary student, whose name was William Peter Blatty, turned it into a book called The Exorcist. Of course, the information that Blatty had to work with was limited. The newspaper stories were vague, no names were listed, and while his old advisor at Georgetown told him that a diary had been kept during the exorcism, there was no way for Blatty to get access to any of those records. But he was able to exchange letters with Father William Bowdern, the Jesuit priest who performed the real-life exorcism in St. Louis. There was only so much the priest could tell him because he'd been ordered not to publicize the case. However, he did tell him that he believed it might be embarrassing and disturbing to the young man involved in the exorcism if he was connected to a book about the events that took place in his life so many years before. He knew that Blatty was writing a novel, but wondered if he could protect the young man's identity in some way. Well, Blatty could, and he did. He changed the young boy in his book to a young girl who would later become known as Reagan McNeil. Now, this is a quote from one of Father Bowdern's letters to Blatty, which makes it clear what he believed about the case. He wrote, "I can assure you of one thing. The case in which I was involved was the real thing. I had no doubt about it then, and I have no doubts about it now." Blatty was so impressed by his contact with the Jesuit that he ended up basing his character of Father Lancaster Marin on Father Bowdern. But Ronald Hunkler's story was not the only exorcism to inspire The Exorcist. It's just the most famous. There was another notorious exorcism that also played a large role in the creation of the book and the film, an exorcism that began in 1912 but didn't end until 16 years later. It was in 1912 that Father Theophilus Reisinger performed his first exorcism on a girl from Marathon, Wisconsin named Anna Eklund, or Emma Schmidt. Both names have been used to protect her identity. She began to manifest signs of demonic possession when she was just 14. Father Reisinger was called on to perform the ritual and was apparently successful at driving the demons out of her. Then in 1928, when Anna was in her 30s, whatever it had been that possessed her before allegedly came back. She again contacted Father Reisinger and asked for help. He was now in Earling, Iowa, and wanted to bring Anna there to perform the exorcism at a Franciscan convent located just outside of town. He received permission from the Reverend Joseph Steiger, who oversaw the parish, and asked him to assist with the exorcism. His story would later become the best eyewitness account to the exorcism, which lasted for 23 days. Father Steiger wrote that during that time, Anna constantly vomited foreign objects, leaves, dirt, even nails. Even though she never ate anything or had access to the things that appeared, she spoke in many different voices, made animal sounds, spoke and understood languages she'd never heard or read before, and foamed at the mouth in a rage when the priests recited the exorcism prayers. She became particularly violent when she was given an object blessed by holy water, even though identical objects that had not been blessed caused her no issues. According to the priest's account of the exorcism, Anna was placed on a bed to which her arms and legs were tied. The strongest nuns in the convent were brought in to hold her onto the bed. But one night, during the exorcism, the ropes that tied her down became loose and Anna levitated into the air. The nuns, it was said, were unable to stop her. Everyone present swore she was carried through the air, landed high above the door to the room, and clung there, stuck to the wall like a spider, or Spider-Man, I guess. Anyway, the nuns dragged her back down and restrained her on the bed again. And after that, she began howling and screaming and twisting her body in ways that the priests later said were impossible. When asked how many spirits possessed Anna, a voice responded there were many, including Anna's own father, a violent and abusive drunk who treated her horribly in life. When Father Reisinger asked what he wanted with his daughter, a voice answered that it wanted to, quote, bring her to despair so that she will commit suicide and hang herself. During the exorcism, the demon inside Anna physically deformed her. Her face became so distorted that she was unrecognizable. Her body was disfigured and her head grew to the size of a watermelon. Her eyes bulged, her lips swelled to the size of her hands, and her body, thin from not eating, swelled so large that the nuns were afraid to stand close to her because they were afraid she might explode. Now, I'm not sure exactly how to describe this for you, so I'll simply refer you to Violet Beauregard in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Anyway, at one point, she became so supernaturally heavy that the iron bed she was on bent down until it reached the floor. Finally, after performing the exorcism for 3 days straight without sleep, an exhausted Father Reisinger finally won the battle on December 23, 1928. At the height of the ritual, Anna stood upright suddenly in her bed, then collapsed. A piercing sound filled the room, followed by the repeated names of all the demons inside her. As the voices faded away, they were replaced by a horrible, unearthly stench. And then it was also gone. Anna, finally herself again, opened her eyes and loudly thanked God. The exorcism was finally at an end, and this time, the demons never returned. She lived out the rest of her life in peace. The story of the exorcism, based on eyewitness accounts, was published in the early 1930s in a 48-page booklet called Begone Satan. It was originally written in German, but when it was translated into English in 1935, the story got a lot of attention in newspapers and even in Time magazine. And that booklet eventually served as research material for William Peter Blatty, adding another layer to what eventually became The Exorcist. William Peter Blatty's book appeared in print in 1971, but it didn't sell at first. Then one night, Blatty was scheduled to appear on the Dick Cavett Show, and as luck would have it, Cavett had been out drinking with friends the night before and allowed Blatty free rein to talk about his new book. And soon after his appearance, it became a massive bestseller. When talk about a film version of the book came along, Blatty was hired to do the screenplay, and William Friedkin was brought on as the director because he was well known for his documentary work. I mean, since the book was inspired by a true story, they wanted to give it a sense of reality. And it worked. He created a film that was not only a great success, but became known as one of the scariest films ever made. And so, if you've ever watched The Exorcist and think, well, it's only a movie, it's not. But it gets worse. Obviously, any film production that lasts for more than a month or so will see its share of accidents and mishaps, but The Exorcist seems to have been affected by more calamities than can be considered normal. Even if these were ordinary happenings, they left the cast and crew very shaken up. The first incident was a fire that started on the completely empty set around 2:30 a.m. It destroyed everything. The cause was a bad electrical circuit, they said, but it shut down filming for 6 weeks while the $200,000 set was rebuilt from scratch. Then, as soon as the set was ready again, the $50,000 air conditioning unit used to create the supernatural chill that caused the actor's breath to show inside the house kept stalling and malfunctioning for no reason. Whenever it stopped working, the ice melted and leaked all over the set. Worse, Friedkin would start to film a scene, only to have the sprinklers go off and flood the set that way too. What happened was a chain reaction that started with the cold room, the breakdown of the air unit, then a rise in temperature so extreme the sprinkler system thought the place was on fire. Few of the actors in the film escaped personal troubles during the shoot. Just as Max von Sydow, who played Father Marin, touched down in New York to film his first scenes, his brother unexpectedly died in Sweden. Von Sydow himself later became very ill during the filming. Jason Miller, who played Father Karras, was stunned when his young son Jordan was struck by a hit-and-run motorcyclist and almost died. Irish actor Jack McGowran, who played director Burke Dennings, died only 1 week after his character was killed in the movie. Vasiliki Malieros, who played Father Karras' mother, also died during the making of the film. One of her scenes had to be cut because it wasn't completed before she passed away. Ellen Burstyn, who played Chris McNeil, badly wrenched her back during one scene when she was slapped by the possessed girl. The stunt went badly awry and she was laid up in bed for several weeks afterward, causing more delays in the filming. And that wasn't the only back injury that occurred. During the scene where Reagan was being thrown back and forth on the bed, special effects were used that required Linda Blair to be rigged to the bed, which moved mechanically, creating what we see in the movie. But during one take, the rigging came loose. The pain caused Linda to scream and cry in pain, begging the crew to stop, but they thought she was just putting on a really good performance. She wasn't. The rigging had fractured her spine, and the injury occurred during the scene that appears in the finished film. It would end up leaving Linda in pain for years, and eventually it developed into scoliosis. And there was more. In New York, one of the carpenters was in the workshop and accidentally cut off his thumb. An overhead light fell and landed on a technician's foot, severing his big toe. Linda Blair's grandfather died during the filming. The assistant cameraman's wife had a baby that died. The man who refrigerated the set died. The janitor who took care of the building was shot and killed. There were 9 deaths that occurred among the cast and crew during the filming of this one movie. There were so many delays that the location trip to Iraq was delayed from the spring, which is relatively cool, to July, the hottest part of the summer, when the temperature rose to as high as 130 degrees. That delay was caused because diplomatic relations between the United States and Iraq had recently broken down because of American support for Israel in the Six-Day War. So it took more than 6 months to get the 18-man crew into the country. And once they started work, one after another started dropping because of heat stroke and dysentery. To make matters worse, the bronze statue of the winged demon Pazuzu, which was packed in a 10-foot crate, got lost in an air shipment between Los Angeles and Baghdad and ended up in Hong Kong instead, which caused another delay. Things became so bad that William Friedkin took some drastic measures. Father Thomas Birmingham and Father John Nicola, both Jesuits who advised and appeared in the film, were asked to bless the set. A ceremony then took place that was attended by everyone, from Max von Sydow down to the technicians and grips. And after that, nothing else tragic occurred on the set, but there were more strange events connected to the post-production of the film. William Friedkin claimed that strange images showed up in the film that had not been shot, including exposure showing 2 images of Linda Blair's face. He also claimed that strange rapping sounds became part of the soundtrack. He had no idea where they'd come from. And then there was Paul Bateson. In 1972, Dr. Barton Lane was performing a medical procedure called an angiogram in the New York University Radiology Lab in Manhattan. At the time, an angiogram, a diagnostic test that takes X-ray pictures of blood vessels, was performed with a needle stuck into the patient's artery. When the needle hit the artery, a jet of blood shot out. While scouting locations for the exorcist, William Friedkin visited Dr. Lane's lab. When he saw the impressive spray of blood that resulted from the test, he told Dr. Lane he wanted to recreate it for the film and wanted everyone in the room to appear in the movie. This included Dr. Lane, a nurse named Nancy, and Paul Bateson, a well-liked and talented radiology technician. In early 1973, Friedkin and his crew returned to the hospital and blocked off the radiology department for 2 weekends to shoot the scene. Anyone who's seen the film will remember this sequence as being one of the most uncomfortable in the entire movie. It involves Reagan being brought in for brain testing by her mother. Reagan is wheeled into an operating room where Paul Bateson assists in conducting the angiogram. He even has some lines in the scene, telling Reagan what he'd actually say to many patients during his career. As he moved the young girl onto the table, Bateson said, "Reagan, can you sit up and scoot over here? A little more. Good." The nurse straps Reagan down and Bateson pushes a button that slowly puts her into position. "Reagan, I'm just going to move you down on the table, okay? Just for a short time," he says. Then Bateson walks around to the front, lowers the top of her gown, and begins to attach wires to her shoulders. "Very sticky," he jokes with her. The scene that follows is one of the most disturbing in the film, likely because it seems so realistic. But when what was happening behind the scenes with the seemingly friendly technician, well, it becomes even more disturbing when you know about that. A few years after the movie came out, Paul Bateson was convicted of the murder and dismemberment of a young man, but the police believed he'd also killed at least 5 other men, some of whom were murdered during the time the film was being made. So there may have been a serial killer on the set of The Exorcist, which might be just as scary as a little girl possessed by a demon. Well, The Exorcist was, of course, eventually completed, and it opened on December 26, 1973, to massive crowds. Within weeks of the first public screenings of the film, stories started to make the rounds that audience members were fainting and vomiting in the theaters. There were also reports of disturbing nightmares, and reportedly dozens of theater ushers had to be placed under a doctor's care or they just quit their jobs after being forced to watch the movie over and over again. In numerous cities that were checked after The Exorcist had run for several weeks, reporters found that every major hospital had been forced to deal with patients who reported, after seeing the film, severe cases of vomiting and hallucinations. There were also reports of people being carried out of theaters in stretchers. Now, were these publicity stunts or the real thing? Well, there's no way to know 50 years later, but they certainly added more fuel to the stories of there being a curse or a jinx on the movie. Rumors quickly spread about the film, including a very controversial one that claimed that real demonic voices recorded during an exorcism can be heard in the film. Friedkin denied this, but he did admit that he had cassette recordings of a real exorcism that he'd witnessed in Rome. And while he claimed he didn't use those actual voices in the film, he did confess that he'd used them as inspiration when he was putting together the soundtrack. But that's definitely not the worst thing that happened after the release of the film. On February 12, 1980, a Wichita Falls, Texas woman named Patricia Ann Frazier watched an edited broadcast version of The Exorcist on CBS television. The film had such an effect on her that she spent the next 10 days in terror. She slowly came to believe that her 4-year-old daughter was possessed, which ultimately led to her gruesomely cutting out the little girl's heart. Well, Patricia was arrested and put on trial, but the jury in her original case was unable to reach a verdict. Her defense attorneys had argued that the exorcist had caused her to genuinely believe her daughter was under the influence of malevolent demons. During her second trial in June 1981, jurors were shown the original version of the film, which seemed to sway them toward believing Patricia's story. The prosecutor, though, insisted she was making the whole thing up. He suggested, without any actual proof, that she had a history of abusing her daughter and had finally killed her. But the jury didn't buy that. In the end, she was found not guilty by reason of insanity, but she was placed under the care of her mother instead of being sent to a mental institution. The jury wasn't convinced she was crazy. They believed the devil, by way of the exorcist, had made her do it. Anyway, rumors of real demonic voices in the soundtrack, murder, fainting, hallucinations, vomiting, none of these things gave the exorcist a great reputation. In fact, the only institution that seemed to love the movie was the Catholic Church. They may not have loved everything about it, but as far as they were concerned, this was the best free advertising they were ever going to get. After the movie came out, attendance at Sunday Mass across the country skyrocketed. But other religious figures weren't so jazzed. Protestant ministers hated everything about the film, from the content, the rumors that surrounded it, and of course, that the Catholics got to be the good guys who came in and saved the day. They made sure to tell their congregations that The Exorcist was dangerous and evil and forbid them to watch it. They tried to get it banned when it came out. After that failed, preacher Billy Graham began claiming there was evil in the very celluloid of the film itself. But whether there was something evil attached to The Exorcist or not, it's a great movie. And definitely the most famous horror film ever made that's based on a true story. And with that, we'll bring an end to this opening episode for Season 9 of American Hauntings. We'll be back in 2 weeks for the first full episode, and my friend and co-host Cody Beck will be right here with me. In fact, I'm pretty sure he'll be bringing the popcorn, along with the answers to the questions you want Cody to ask, listener reviews, texts from the haunt line, and much more. And while you're waiting for that episode to drop, be sure to check out the American Hauntings Patreon program and delve into the first episode of the new season of our alternative podcast. This season is called Monster, and it tells the terrifying true story of Albert Fish. And you can find out more about that at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. So until next time, just remember, it's only a movie. Or is it?
Taxes was waiting around for your taxes to be done, which led to worrying about not getting any money back. Now Taxes is matching with a TurboTax expert who can do your taxes in a day to get you up to $4,000 fast with a refund advance loan. Now this is Taxes. Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Expert filing only available with TurboTax Live Full Service. Refund advance has $0 loan fees and 0% APR. Refund advance loans may be issued by First Century Bank, N.A. or Web Bank. Terms apply. Subject to approval.